Okay, so yep, looks like it's recording. Awesome. Well, this is the first of the trail running seminars. And what I thought I'd do today is just talk really briefly about, first of all, what are we supplementing with? And then I'll talk about the different kinds of workouts that we're going to be doing over the next several weeks until the end of July, when we do the trail competition. So to start off with, this astaxanthin that we're taking is we're taking different formulations of it and different dosages of it. What's been studied now so far is dosages anywhere from 4 milligrams a day to 12 milligrams a day have been shown to have antioxidant effects, to have protection of your mitochondria, which are the little organelles inside your cells that generate energy, and I'll talk about why that's important in just a little bit. There have been studies to show that cyclists who supplement with astaxanthin are able to generate more power on the bicycle, so we're testing that as part of our study. There have been studies to show that runners who supplement with it are able to have improved endurance, so we're evaluating that as well. But let's talk a little bit about why astaxanthin is an interesting supplement. What we're supplementing with is an extract from a microalgae called Haematococcus pluvialis. That's just an algae that's typically a green algae floating in the water, and it turns red or pink after the sunlight hits it. And it does it because when the sunlight hits it, that ultraviolet light is causing oxidative damage to the plant. And so the plant makes this astaxanthin to protect itself from that ultraviolet damage. So we can supplement with that. The astaxanthin that we're taking right now, it's important to know that it's a natural source. A lot of the astaxanthin on the market is synthetic. It's made from petroleum byproducts. And the structure of the astaxanthin that you get, natural versus synthetic, is completely, completely different. Your body doesn't absorb the synthetic very well. It gets rid of the synthetic very quickly. So even if you supplement with it, it's washed out of your body very, very fast. And it's not as effective. The structure of the astaxanthin molecule from a natural source is different, and because it's different, it's much more effective as an antioxidant than the synthetic form. So it's really, really important whether you're supplementing with the particular one that we're using here, or you go and you buy it on your own at the shelf, you want to make sure that you're getting a natural form because it's much, much more effective. Your body uses it better, your body retains it better, it has an overall better biological effect. So the fact that it's natural is really important. So where do you find it naturally? You know, we're getting it from this algae source, but you can also get it from salmon and trout and shrimp and krill. The reason that krill and shrimp and salmon are pink is because they have a high content of astaxanthin. So instead of supplementing with krill, which is, you know, there are krill supplements out there that have a good level of astaxanthin in them, we're supplementing directly with the microalgae. So that way we get a very high, very pure source of it. So, you know, astaxanthin is the category that you would put it in of an antioxidant is that it's a carotenoid, right? So there's beta carotene that makes carrots orange. There's lycopene that makes tomatoes red. There's lutein that makes marigolds and egg yolks yellow. This pink red astaxanthin is what makes that salmon pink or the algae red. That color is indicative of its antioxidant ability. But one of the things that's so cool about astaxanthin is that it crosses the blood-brain barrier, which is interesting. Most carotenoids don't do that. Most antioxidants in general don't do that. It's both hydrophilic and hydrophobic, which means that it's water-soluble and fat-soluble. And that's really, really unique. Typically, an antioxidant, you might have something like a vitamin C is water-soluble. So that can protect your body from free radicals only in the aqueous portions of your body, in your blood, or on the inside of your your cell. You could have an antioxidant like vitamin E that's fat soluble, and that can only protect your body in the cell membranes where it's fat soluble. Astaxanthin can do it all because it has a very unique chemical structure where it spans the entire cell membrane. So you get the hydrophilic, the water-loving part of it, on the outsides of the membrane, and the hydrophobic, the fat-loving, the lipid-soluble, on the middle part of the membrane. So you get an antioxidant that is more effective against different kinds of damaging molecules. So that's one of the things that makes it very interesting. Another thing that's interesting, I've written an entire book about how antioxidants can be bad for us if we supplement them at too high a level. So vitamin C is a good example. If you supplement with, if you have too little vitamin C, that's bad because you can't protect yourself at all. If you take the right amount of vitamin C, you're going to be able to protect yourself against certain kinds of free radicals. If you take too much vitamin C, it can actually start causing the same sort of oxidative damage that you're trying to protect yourself from. So I wrote a whole book called Deadly Antioxidants that tries to educate people about, you don't want too little, you don't want too much because that can cause damage. You want someplace in the middle, sort of the Goldilocks effect, right? Not too hot, not too cold, someplace in the middle, just right. Astaxanthin can't become a pro-oxidant like that. So the whole idea of over-supplementing with antioxidants, you can't do that with astaxanthin. You can't take too much of it. It won't cause that sort of oxidative overdrive, that pro-oxidant effect. So that's a very good effect of astaxanthin. Astaxanthin's unique in that it also is anti-inflammatory. So the antioxidant side of it to protect your cells is great. From the you know, when we're running, we're generating a lot of oxidative molecules, right? From just breathing. That's good just to protect ourselves. It's good to protect us from the ultraviolet light when we're out there running on the trails, from the sunlight. But it also reduces inflammation, which is a completely separate process where we want, it's the same thing with balance. We want a little bit of inflammation to protect our bodies and help us repair, but we don't want too much inflammation that's going to lead to a tendinitis or an arthritis or some sort of an over-inflammation. Astaxanthin can help with inflammation as well. And then the piece that's really important, and probably the one that we're studying the most in this trial, is the effect of astaxanthin to protect mitochondria. So your mitochondria is what generates your energy. That's what burns our fat. That's what gives our cells the ATP to fuel muscle contractions. Mitochondria get damaged because of the oxidative metabolism that they're doing. So they're creating energy, they're using a lot of oxygen, they're right at the ground zero for oxidative metabolism. So if we can protect them from damage, that's good. But then if they're not damaged, they're going to produce more energy. And that's what is going to be driving our power output and our endurance and our fat burning. And so astaxanthin is really protecting the mitochondria, making the mitochondria more efficient so we can produce more energy so we can exercise harder. And that's exactly what we think we'll see at the end of this trial, is that people who have been supplementing with astaxanthin are going to be able to show better VO2 max, better fat burning, better power output, better recovery, less overall stress in their bodies because we're controlling inflammatory stress and oxidative stress. So that's the general idea of what we're supplementing with and why. Does that make sense to everybody? Does anyone have any questions about what we're doing?
Nope.
Okay, cool. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about why we're doing the workouts that we're doing. So the whole goal here is to really do 3 running workouts every week. And that doesn't sound like a lot. It doesn't sound like a lot because a lot of people who run as their training method of choice, and who are training for something like the half marathon that we're all training for, run more than that. They might run every single day. They might run 6 days a week. You don't have to do that because a lot of the runs that people end up doing are junk runs. They're out there, they're working, they're exercising, they're burning calories, but they're not really doing anything good for their overall progress. And what I mean by that is that if we just do 3 runs a week, if we do one interval workout, one hill workout, and one long, slow distance workout, that's enough. That's going to be enough of a running load to get us to where we want to be. If you're training for the Olympics, great. You're probably going to be running, 10 times, 12 times a week. You're going to be doing 2-a-days. But for the level of training that we're trying to do, that's really all you need to do. Once you start doing more runs than that, your risk for injury increases exponentially. So your risk for getting a tendonitis or a little ache or you're an IT band or something like that goes up really, really fast. So what I'm recommending for the next several weeks until we get to the race is a weekly goal of one interval workout, one hill workout, and one long slow distance or LSD workout. If you want to work out, I'm going to work out other days and do other things, but on those other days when I'm not running, I'll be doing some sort of a cross training, right? I'll be lifting weights, we'll be doing riding my mountain bike, riding my road bike, rowing. Some people will like to do yoga. That's not really my thing, but lots of people like to do that. If I want to run a fourth time or a fifth time, it's a tempo workout, and that's just a workout to like help with your mind, loosen your legs, take the dogs for a run, that kind of thing. So one of the mistakes people make when they're training and when they're running is that they go at sort of a medium intensity, right? That's what I call a tempo workout. This is the kind of workout where you go out and you run at a pace where you feel like you got a good workout, sort of in quotes. That's not really doing anything for you in terms of making you faster or making you stronger. That's what I mean by sort of a junk workout, right? So sometimes it feels good to go do a tempo workout, right? It feels good to go at a rating of perceived exertion, which I probably should explain in a second, of about 6 to 7. Medium intensity, it's not really making you faster, it's not really making you stronger, it's not really giving you better endurance. If you do all your runs at that sort of medium intensity, you're going to race at a medium speed. And that maybe that's what you want to do. But I think a lot of people want to try to, hit a PR or, run a distance that they haven't run before or, place in their age group or whatever. So the best use of a tempo workout really is just, hey, I had a stressful day, I'm going to go out and work out the stress. Hey, I had a hard bike ride yesterday, or I lifted weights with my legs, I'm going to go out and loosen up my legs. Or like I joked around before, we're taking the dogs for a workout. But if you do all your workouts in that tempo speed, you're just going to be sort of average. So let's talk about RPE for a second, rating of perceived exertion. This is just as accurate as running by heart rate, right? So a lot of people like to track their heart rate, and they like to know exactly what zone they're in, and they like to have sort of ranges. You don't necessarily have to do that. If people are interested in that from our VO2 test, I can give you your specific heart rate ranges that you should be in. But it's just as accurate to train by your perceived exertion. So RPE is a 1 to 10 scale, with 10 being an all-out sprint and 1 being really, really easy. Like sitting here right now listening to this lecture, that's a 1, right? Eating lunch is a 1. Having a cup of coffee is a 1, right? You wouldn't work out at that intensity. So if your tempo workout is sort of midway between there, sort of a 5, 6, 7 sort of a thing, your intervals and your hill workouts are going to be not a 10, you're never sprinting, but they're going to be somewhere between a 7 to 9. This would roughly correspond, if you're a heart rate trained person, a 7 to 9 is going to roughly correspond to 150, 160, 170 beats, right? That's about where you're going to be. So pretty hard, right? And repeated efforts. So when you do your intervals, what you're training is speed. You're going to be on flat or rolling courses. You're going to be doing a hard interval and then an easy interval, and then a hard interval and then an easy interval. And that's really important, that you go hard when you're supposed to go hard and easy when you're supposed to go easy. Don't go medium hard and medium easy, right? That falls back into the danger of that sort of medium zone where what happens with a medium zone training is that you strain your body, but you don't recover enough. And so you're not quite getting faster. You're getting sort of in a place where you're putting strain on the body, but you're not recovering quite enough. And so that's really more risky for your injury profile than going hard and going easy. The worst thing an athlete can do is go medium. So we want to make sure that we're not doing that, right? When it's time to go hard, go 7 or 8 or 9 on that fast part of your interval for 60 seconds. And then when you go easy, really easy, like walking if you need to, or just diddling along in terms of jogging. You really want to make sure that you're getting fully recovered so that on that next hard one, you can truly go hard again. Okay? With intervals, some people like to go to a track and do it around a track so it's very consistent in terms of the terrain. I like to just do my intervals on the trail. You know, I'll pick a turn up ahead and I'll say, okay, I'm going to do my fast up to that turn, and then when I get there, I'm going to really shut it off. And sometimes I'll walk a few steps and then jog slowly for a minute and then I'll go again. And so you can do that while you're out on the trails. You can do it when you're on the pavement. You can pick telephone poles. You can time it with your watch if you want to. Sometimes these are called fartlek workouts where you're just going hard, easy, hard, easy, hard, easy. But make sure that you're having that separation between hard and easy and not going medium. This will make you much, 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 much faster. One thing to keep in mind too when you're doing your intervals is that you probably want to speed up your foot cadence. So during the fast interval, try to think about fast feet. Try to think about shortening your strides instead of lengthening your strides. There's actually some really good research to show that when you shorten your strides like that during a fast interval, you're covering a faster period of ground. So your pace is a lot faster if you're using shorter steps versus trying to lengthen out your stride. So with hills, that's the second part of the workout, second type of workout that we're going to be doing every week. This is really to build your strength. So ideally, you're going to find a hill that is about 60 to 90 seconds for you to crest. And your same rating of perceived exertion, 7 to 9. You want to make that uphill hard, and then you want to turn around. Or if you're cresting the hill and you're going off to another hill, you want to make sure that down or that easy part is really, really easy. Stay out of that medium zone. And that's hard for people because the medium zone is where a lot of people are used to being most of the time. And we need to get out of that mindset and say, nope, we're going to go hard and we're going to go easy. And we're going to go hard and we're going to go easy. And you just repeat that for however many hill repeats you have that particular week. So for this week coming up, I think I had prescribed 3 to 5 intervals on the interval day and 3 to 5 hills on the hill day. So as we progress in our intensity over the week, we're not going to be doing these any harder. Our rating of perceived exertion is still going to be 7 to 9 on each of those efforts, but we'll be doing more of them. So, you know, this week coming up, we'll be doing 3 to 5. The next week, we might be doing 4 to 6. The next week, we might be doing 5 to 7, and we'll just increase the workload that way. So we've got our intervals for speed. That's going to help our pace in the race. We've got hills for strength. That's going to help our ability.